Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Private Eye offices, joined as ever by Adam McQueen, Helen Lewis and Ian Hislop. We're here to discuss the stories that have transpired since the last issue of the magazine was published, and who knows, maybe to discuss some of the stories that might come out in the next issue of Private Eye. Obviously, the main story this week internationally is the ongoing, incredibly bleak situation in the Middle East. That was covered in quite a lot of detail in the last issue of Private Eye. And if you're interested in what readers thought of it, there is going to be a full rundown on the letters page. Lots and lots of letters, both for and against. So you'll be able to read all of those in great detail in the next issue of the magazine. But so that we're not giving you the same thing twice over, we thought that this time we would start with a story from a little bit closer to home, a story that happened just after we had gone to press last time, and frankly, a story that isn't quite as depressing. We are talking about a British political story, in particular, that of the two by-elections that happened last week in Tamworth and Mid-Bedfordshire, in which the people of those places decided that they wanted to make a long-term decision for a brighter future, which didn't involve Rishi Sunak at all.
Were you expecting them to be both Tory losses, Andy? Because I honestly thought they might just hang on to one of them.
I'm so bad at predicting things that I really didn't. I couldn't have put it one way or the other. And I mean, I'm also very easily gulled by expectation management from either party saying, oh, well, we you know, governments always lose by-elections and it's perfectly natural. So I thought, well, maybe they will. Clearly,
there was a lot of that, wasn't there?
There was a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious of which was Greg Hands, the Tory chairman. Somehow, mysteriously, a briefing from him was leaked. Who can say from whence it came, saying, we are going to definitely lose all these. It's very sad. Which is absolutely just the nailed-on classic thing that parties do before by-election results come out. They go, we're going to do absolutely terrible. I mean, at this point in the electoral cycle, who would even expect us to do well? Mm. The idea being that then you do slightly better than that, and everyone goes, oh, it's absolutely amazing. Ran into a certain amount of trouble in this one, in that the Tories put out a thing saying, we think we're going to do terribly. And then they indeed did do terribly.
Part two of this is the bit that's not working out. They did the same thing ahead of the last council elections, didn't they? Said, you know, it might be as many as 1,000 seats we might lose.
And they lost.
Wow, that would be absolutely astonishing. And they lost several hundred more than a thousand. You do have to also just rely on the second part going well, don't you? And it really didn't. I mean, in this case, it was two fairly stonking turnarounds, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Huge. And very interesting in that, you know, the Lib Dems campaigned quite hard in one of the seats in Mid-Bedfordshire, which is Nadine Dorries' old seat. And yeah, the Tory vote absolutely cratered. And the best you could say if you're a Tory strategist would be it was very low turnout and the MPs were both leaving under really unpleasant circumstances.
Mm. But they had been for a while. I mean, a certain amount, you know...
Nadine had been leaving for a while. Well, forever, I think.
They did announce she was going a few months ago. But the Chris Pincher thing, that dates back to late Boris Johnson. So that a certain amount of that might have been priced in. And there were... I think the candidate in
Tamworth was bad. That was Andrew Cooper who said about people who don't work that they should fuck off. The candidate in Mid-Bedfordshire...
It wasn't people who don't work, it's people who can't feed their children, he said, should fuck off. And his wife pointed out, this was 3 whole years ago, which is not actually as ancient history as yet. It is still this parliament, so yeah.
Yeah, but worse, I think the candidate in Mid-Bedfordshire, which was Festus Akinbosoye, who was a very well-liked PCC, Police and Crime Commissioner, he was actually a decent candidate and he nonetheless got whacked. So that was a really bad one. The other interesting subplot is the fact that Reform, the party of Richard Tice, GB News favourite Richard Tice, took about 1,500 votes in both of them. So actually really is going to probably nip into the Tory vote in places where they really can't afford to lose a single vote. And that's sad. I'm sad about that for them. I'm not sad at all. they created that monster and now it's rampaging around the country, eating people's faces. That's their problem.
I suppose hence all the headlines about why we're going to need to let Rishi be even more Rishi. And the big offer might be things like cutting inheritance tax or raising the threshold for income tax. He's stuck in a car that can only turn right.
And there is a point to saying that actually the tax thresholds have been stuck at the same level while income tax, you know, while inflation has gone up, right? So it's this thing called fiscal drag. More and more people are being captured by that. That said, that is also the kind of cohort of middle-class, middle-aged people who are on the cusp of, you know, there's a kind of great hinge in British politics, right? No young people vote Tory, lots of old people vote Tory, and then there's some mysterious alchemical process that happens to you about 50-something where you just go, oh, I don't like this at all.
I think it's about the same time that you look at those adverts in the back of magazines and go, Red trousers. I could get a pair of them. Oh, a gilet.
Maybe I should get a seat in my shower.
I hope you're not being rude about our advertisers.
Please, can you not be rude about the Shetland crew neck and the...
That's a nice jumper, actually.
These are very
natty.
I could
get one of those.
There you are.
I'm nearly at that age.
I think the threshold is now 65. I'm not sure the Conservatives even have a need in the 55 to 64 age range, which is quite far up.
Right.
Over 65,
those are people they
high.
Need to win back. Those are people who might plausibly, you know, people who maybe are on the way to owning their own home, for example.
Once they're 55.
yeah, move out of their parents' spare room, finally. They've paid off their student loan.
Look forward to it, Andy. It's going to be a great day for you.
Can't wait. So, yeah, you're right about the reform. The reform thing is really interesting. As in, Reform Party keeps deposit is a headline that is...
Yeah, they got 5% in Tamworth. They were the only party apart from Labour and Tories to keep their deposit. Mm. But they could just... You know, the Tories cannot afford to lose a single vote to their right, given how many they're losing to their left and to the Lib Dems, wherever they now sit in British politics. Let's not go into it. And I agree with you. There's not that many options. They can culture war harder, but then they're going to lose to the Lib Dems in the southwest.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of space for them. The thing they would obviously like to do is make the economy go amazingly well, but I think we'd all like that, obviously, for selfish reasons.
So the Suella's six-point plan for Britain leaked by, I mean, again, who knows who? I mean, I can't imagine who put all that in. I mean, that is just pressurising Sunak to keep right.
Well, I think it's going, do you know who would be a great Tory leader were the worst to happen? And there only to be three cabinet ministers still having their seats, and I happen to be one of them, me, Suella. And, you know, Kemi Badenoch had been out and done the same thing for Tory conference, giving an interview going, you know who hates wokeness? Kemi Badenoch, that's who.
Yeah.
So there's, it's nice. I feel it's very efficient that they're getting the next Tory leadership race over now, maybe a year out from the next election. Oh,
there has been, I think, much too fevered speculation about that, because once Rishi Sunak's been in office for a year, which I think might be around the day this podcast is published, then letters will be allowed. You can send in a letter to
you
the
can send in a letter
committee.
Any time, but yeah, that you can't.
It won't be, he won't count, is it?
You get a year's grace period. It's like a sort of, you know, trial at a job.
It's just saving time, basically, after the election, isn't it? Because, I mean, those Tory leadership things, they go on for ages. You know, there's about five rounds before it even goes out to the party members, isn't it? So actually, I mean, just the fact that they're doing the hustings already is, we'll be well ahead. We can just go, day after Rishi leaves Downing Street, we can just get straight on with the voting.
Can I just say that the next Tory leader is going to be Keir Starmer?
I just
wanted to add a bit of politics in there and reinforce my reputation as very left-wing.
Yeah.
Extremely left-wing.
Thank you.
I'm sure you've seen the news that Liz Truss will be releasing her own budget a week before the actual budget, which struck me as, surely that's losing the web of fence, isn't it? Are you allowed to just run your own shadow government from within? Or rather from without?
Is it like what? Like a sort of fantasy football league?
It's a fantasy football one. She's saying if we only cut these taxes, she's talking about the tourist tax, which the Mail's been running a big campaign on, then bada, growth, which she's the first person ever to think of, which is very exciting. But, I mean,
and I suppose she can't be proved wrong, can she? I mean,
because
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people seem to have, the Telegraph certainly seem to have forgotten that she was proved quite spectacularly wrong the last time she actually got to do this for real. But it's kind of just
budget.
Safer.
Why doesn't she just announce a fake cabinet? I mean,
is this just basically they're locking her in a room with just like a pad of paper and a pencil and say, go on, you get it. Just run your own government and it's just, you can't do any harm.
Well, and then the Telegraph will report it.
Yeah, as if it's actually happened. It's a complete virtual reality now. It's Truss's world.
Yeah. There is a kind of coterie of people around her, like Jonathan Isby of Taxpayers, formerly of Taxpayers Alliance, and people like that, who have always believed in it. You know, they're kind of... This has been their political project for the last 20 years. And a little thing like the fact it tanked the economy and put everyone's mortgages up is not going to stop them making that case even harder.
Yeah.
And they can't even use the, traditional extreme argument on either sides is, well, it's never been practiced in its purest form. And we said it was. It was practiced last year. We had it.
Right,
but it wasn't given a chance. It was only given 49 days, so it doesn't count.
But that's exactly it. No, central to the argument is the idea of something called treasury brain, right? That the treasury is the blob, the treasury is standing in the way of promise. You know, and they were helped by the fact that one of the senior mandarins at the Foreign Office, was it, said, I gave a speech after Brexit saying how terrible it was, we all thought it was. The idea that they're prosecuting is, if only the civil service had been on our side, like true trussism has never been tried and we were stopped. Yeah. And that's why the alternative budget is about. It's about saying the Treasury won't let us do all these great ideas we've got. This is what you could have had, even though you had it and you didn't like it.
Even the point of that civil servant speech after Brexit was, yes, we've all got opinions about this. You might think it's really appalling. The point is, we have to do the job in a neutral way. I mean, it was reported in a very different way to the actual content within it.
But the civil servant in the Treasury who was sacked didn't just say, you know, it's my job to support the government. He said, I think this is such a terrible idea. You really, really shouldn't do it. So she sacked him. And he was doing his job, which is to point out the terrible ideas.
Was that Tom Scholar?
Yeah.
I did see this phrase gets used a lot, captured by the Treasury. It's quite sinister. So-and-so has been captured by the Treasury. Mm. I saw it last being used about Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, who you would think would have been captured by the Treasury. That's not an unnatural...
Yes,
it's but what's meant by captured by the Treasury is you've had an idea like universal gold bars to be given out to everyone at post offices, and someone in the Treasury says, we can't afford that.
Yeah.
And then you're captured.
And just one last thing on this. We might get another by-election soon if we're very good, which is that in the constituency, Wellingborough, of Peter Bone.
Peter Bone.
Yeah.
Bone by name?
Well.
Bone heavily denied by nature.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you for that legally same joke.
Absolutely. Because he's lost the whip after it was a parliamentary report found that he had been bullying staff.
Also sexually harassing them by offering them massages, walking into a room in a state of undress on a foreign trip. The interesting thing that raises about this is a bit about this wider cleanup of Westminster, is that some of these foreign trips that are taken by all-party parliamentary groups have always been acknowledged to be a bit of a jolly. Mm. But the idea that you go along and you take your junior staff with you, I think is now looking a bit more, you know, people are looking at that a bit more askance.
It's a bit more creepy than jolly, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's part of that wider thing in the same way of not allowing MPs to employ their families and spouses anymore, of trying to turn it into a normal workplace. And in a normal workplace, if you're a middle-aged man, you don't normally get to go, wouldn't it be lovely, isn't Georgia lovely this time of year? Why don't we go on a small trip?
And Bona's on a majority of 18,500, which we now know is wafer thin. So we will see. Watch this space. We should have a little bit more international news, but in a different direction. And in fact, it's about, I was about to say friend of the eye. Well, you know, people have been... Donald Trump isn't really a friend of the eye.
Cover star, should we go with that? He's probably got a few of those. Yeah, star. Probably some of which got quite a big post bag as well, I should imagine.
Yeah, who is coming to the courtroom, but hoping to come
to the courtroom. Hoping, first of all, to be allowed to come to the courtroom. This was an initial hearing to see whether the case is allowed to go ahead. But then also hoping that we'll still be able to come into the courtroom, won't be in prison because of one of his many, many, many other legal cases. But this is unusually, yes, this is a legal case in which Donald Trump is the claimant rather than the respondent. And he's brought a case in the English courts against Christopher Steele, the former MI5 man who... And you really do have to have a reminder on this because so much has happened in the interim. This is pre-Donald Trump even becoming president and all the things he's done since. But he wants to make it very, very, very clear that story everyone's forgotten about him being weed on by the Russian prostitutes, is not true, and he wasn't weed on by the Russian prostitutes. So if everyone could just remember that he was not weed on by Russian prostitutes, okay?
No, I don't want to... fact check the wee to a ludicrous degree, but I in the Guardian I thought it was that the prostitutes were weighing on each other and he was merely watching Adam. So I just
okay.
This is the kind of thing we can expect to see cleared up in
between
the court
us.
Case.
I think
Does
we mind agree? If I leave?
I think we can agree that Mr. Trump took no steps whatsoever to defile the bed in which President Mrs. Obama had slept. I think that's that he didn't engage in unorthodox behaviour, whatever the heck that
I think
means.
He has. He's not going to defend that one, is he? He's done some pretty unorthodox.
It's all unorthodox. His whole life has been pretty unorthodox. You're right. Yeah. But anyway, so he's trying to sue Orbis, which is the consultancy that wrote this report, Christopher Steele, who's the ex-MI5 guy who compiled the report.
Yep, a top secret report, which was then leaked to BuzzFeed. Now, he's not claiming that Christopher Steele or Orbis were responsible for it being leaked and becoming public.
Right.
And also, he's not claiming libel, which is what you would normally want to do if you were trying to deny something such as the fact that you were weed on or weed near by prostitutes.
Can we just say unorthodox behaviour? I think that would just cover
the unorthodox behaviour of being weed on by prostitutes. Yeah.
I think when it first came out, I thought it was the shower was a reference to the hotel room amenities. I'd completely got the wrong end of this, but
so to speak. Yes.
My interventions are of no interest. I'm terribly sorry. Continue.
This is a story that everyone had forgotten about. I had to dredge it up when
it
I
is.
Saw
yeah,
the
yeah. I mean, given that everything's happening, you know, including fermenting an insurrection against the government of the United States, you would kind of think that was kind of more of an issue, wouldn't
that is
you?
More but of no, an issue.
This is something that apparently has been bugging him ever since 2016 when this okay. first came out. But the fact that it is so old means that he is unable to sue for libel. So instead, and this is very odd for a story that you are denying is true, he is suing under data protection law to say that this was misuse of his personal information. Mm. But then also very, very insistent that the personal information wasn't personal information because it wasn't true either. So legally, but this is quite a peculiar one.
Is it that the report contains personal information? The compiling of the report is personal information, whether or not it's true?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets really, really interesting, because it is quite difficult if you're a spy compiling a dossier on someone to not handle their personal information and find out things about them and then retain that yeah. personal information. And actually, this is where legally this is quite interesting, because this has been a trend in British law over the last kind of decade or so that's been used by an awful lot of people. We saw the bottom fell out of the libel market years and years ago. You didn't get money for libel anymore. Then it all went over to privacy and it went over to super injunctions. And then suddenly there's this second weapon in the armory of very, very expensive law firms, which has become very much part of the slaps actions of recent years and that whole lawfare thing, which is that you also take action against journalists and media outlets as well for under data protection rules, which are designed mostly for people who are running mailing lists, who are running businesses where they have enormous amounts of people's personal information. Quite rightly, there are
GDPR.
Laws in place. It's GDPR stuff, so it's about the retention of personal information and what is done with it and not being able to sell it on and stuff. But it has been used, and specifically there have been a couple of cases. There was one brought by a very, very prominent businessman who was attempting to stop both a newspaper and a freelance journalist who he sued personally to try and under data protection rules to say that this GDPR stuff applied to them and that they had to destroy any information that they held on him. Now, I'm being slightly cagey about this business person's identity because he's now involved in an ongoing enormous criminal trial. So that gives you a clue as to why people might want to be using laws like these to stop journalists finding out and retaining information about them. But it also popped up...
this caution.
This it also just... popped up. So we'll do one more name and shame. Mohamed Amersi, who we have written about endlessly in Private Eye and talked about on this podcast before, who was suing Charlotte Leslie. The initial one of three legal actions, and now there's an appeal, so we're up to four, he took against her was under data protection rules as well, which he then later abandoned and decided to go for a more simple defamation action instead. A famous case, which again, I'm afraid the courts say I have to be slightly cagey over, ZXC versus Bloomberg, which set all sorts of complicated precedents in terms of privacy law, but that was also all to do with data protection as well and what information journalists were allowed to have about people. Now, there are exemptions in data protection law which does allow journalism in the public interest, but as ever, they're loosely enough worded that the clever and well-paid lawyers are able to attempt to exploit them for their own ends. And can we just do a quick pop quiz on this one? Can you guess who Trump's lawyer is in the English courts as he takes this action?
Is it? Give us a clue. Is it a famous British lawyer?
It is a famous British lawyer. We've written about him on a number of occasions.
I'm just trying to think. Is it Schilling?
This is the barrister who's representing him.
Oh, the
after.
Barrister. Mm. Forgive me. I was looking at reputation management specialists as they're now.
Well, he's very much in that area. It's not David Sherburne. It's the other one. It's Hugh Tomlinson, chair of Press Freedom Campaign, hacked off, and previous representative of such glorious figures as the aforementioned Mohamed Amersi. He was with him for a bit. Sir Frederick... Goodwin and
Fred the Shred
of the Royal Bank of Scotland, Ryan Giggs, remember that super injunction, Rebecca Vardy, the gangster David Hunt as well, who took the Sunday Times to court.
You've got to hope he's going to have a Christmas party at some point for all these people.
Well, if he is, he's going to have a yacht to host it on, because he's also Roman Abramovich's lawyer.
Whee!
So all the charmers out there.
Are you attempting to suggest that senior barristers do not work on a cab rank principle, or the fact that all of these people happen to be at the same cab rank?
It's just a very, very expensive cab, and it's people with a lot of money for their rides home, isn't it?
Finally, we should talk about a bit of really sad news at The Eye, which is that the news that last week, Tony Husband, who's been a cartoonist at The Eye for 40 years, has died.
At least.
Yeah. He drew Yobs and he drew lots of other things for The Eye. And obviously, Ian, you'll have known him best out of all of us.
Yes, I mean, Tony was an incredibly sweet man and also a very brilliant cartoonist. And there's been a sort of outpouring of love for Tony online and people putting up his own cartoons. He was incredibly prolific, Tony. So you would say, have you got any cartoons? And then a lorry would arrive with roughs on it. He was endlessly optimistic. So if you said he didn't like that, he'd give you something else. If you don't want that one, I'll have this one.
Are you sure he was a cartoonist? He doesn't sound like a cartoonist at the moment. Cheerful, optimistic.
He was responsible for the Yob strip, which over the years, Tony said, was just pure therapy for him. He said, it's my revenge on all the people who beat me up when I was younger. And he was incredibly funny about it and totally unapologetic. He sort of said, well, you know, you can't say this is an attack on the working classes because it's by me and I want to do it. Again, it was odd that that was the focus because the majority of his cartoons over the years were mostly about middle-aged people sitting in chairs saying, let's go crazy, or dogs.
He was so good at dogs, wasn't he?
And he was a total outsider to journalism, wasn't he? So he grew up in a working class family and then just sent in some cartoons to you? Was that how he got hired?
Yeah, I think he'd done a dog biscuit magazine. I may have got that detail wrong. I think he'd had professional recognition earlier on. No, I mean, he was like a lot of our cartoonists. The thing that distinguishes them from the people who aren't get published is they sent stuff in. And with Tony's stuff, very, very quickly, you take no credit when someone that good comes along. You just, well, obviously I do take credit as much as possible later, but essentially you're just thinking, this is extraordinary. Why haven't you been in before? And his style is, it's naive, but beautifully drawn. And again, people say, oh, your cartoonists can't draw. And you say, no, they can draw, but they draw in a very specific way.
They're choosing not to.
But it is. I mean, I was saying about the dogs, the facial expressions on his dogs were extraordinary. There was one of the ones we put up on Twitter on the day that Tony died. It's one of my favourite ones of two dogs with little angel wings and halos sitting on a cloud. And one of them is just turning to the other and saying, well, I don't call it heaven when we're not allowed to sniff each other's bottoms. But the facial expressions of the dogs, they just look absolutely devastating. As they look forward to this eternity of awfulness. And it's two lines and two dots. I mean, I'm utterly in awe of how cartoonists do it. And Tony really was one of the best.
Okay, that's it from us this week. Thank you very much to Adam, Helen and Ian. We'll be back in a fortnight with another episode of the podcast. And until then, subscriptions to the magazine are very much available. So go and get one now.
Just so many have been cancelled. Yeah.
There are lots of very early subscription numbers you can snap up.
Oh, gosh.
Just go to private-i.co.uk and there are two buttons there. One says complain and one says subscribe. Click a subscribe one, please. And yes, we'll be back again. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time.